This season, let your shoes do the talking. Designer Shoe Warehouse is packed with fresh styles that speak to your whole vibe without saying a word. From cool sneakers that look good with everything to easy sandals you'll want to wear on repeat, DSW has you covered. Find a shoe for every you from the brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, New Balance, and more. Head to your DSW store or visit DSW.com today.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome James Tooley, the author of two books about education in the world and coming to America. The new book is Really Good Schools, Global Lessons for High-Caliber, Low-Cost Education, just published. And the earlier book is about education as well, published in the first decade of this century, The Beautiful Tree, A Personal Journey into How the World's Poorest People Are Educating Themselves. James, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this, and congratulations. I begin with your discovery of low-cost schools. You are a philosopher of education, self-described. And yet one day, in exploring the schools of India, I believe, you became curious about the poorest parts of Indian schools and how they were organized. And that led you to discover that not everything is state-run in India or anywhere else. What did you discover in India? Where and how did you come to this revelation about self, about private schools for low cost? Good evening to you.
Good evening, yes. So that's right. I was a philosopher of education. That was my PhD was in philosophy of education. And for various reasons, I'd become an expert on global education, and I was doing consultancy for the International Finance Corporation, which is the private arm of the World Bank. I was in Hyderabad in South Central India. This was 21 years ago now, and I was doing consultancy work about elite private schools, elite private colleges, and for whatever reason, this didn't satisfy me. My life should be about the poor, should be about the less blessed in society. And here I was doing consultancy, which would only help the rich. And so on a day off from this consultancy work, I took a auto rickshaw, one of the three-wheeler vehicles, down into the old city where I knew the slums of the old city were behind this building called the Char Minar, the Arc de Triomphe of South Central India. And I wandered into these slums, actually with a hunch about what I might find. We can come to why I had this hunch. I wandered into these slums, and there I found a school. It was a school that was charging about $1 a month in those days. It was a private school, a low-cost private school. Then I found another and another, and soon was in touch with a federation of 500 of these low-cost private schools. Now, I discovered them from the outside. In those days, no one outside, you know, had heard of these. No one in America or England had heard of these schools, or if they had, they thought they were quite a, you know, rare, unusual phenomenon. But I became part of that. You know, I became, you know, linked with this group of 500 schools, and I became serious about investigating this phenomenon because it seemed to me, why was no one talking about this? And, you know, in the initial days, I looked in India, and I asked to see the government school because I talked to parents, and they said, you know, I said, well, why are you sending your children to a private school? You're, you know, I didn't quite say this, but you're poor. In the government school, there's free lunch, there's free books. You have to pay money. Why are you sending your children here? And parents would say, in the government school, our children are abandoned. And I went to see for myself, and it was an image I shall have with me forever. I went into this government school. The first class, it was a nice building, much nicer than the private school buildings. The first classroom I visited, there were 130 kids sitting on the floor doing nothing, being supervised by one teacher with a stick. And I realized then that these eager young children waiting, you know, so eager to meet this stranger, they were abandoned because the teachers didn't come to school and teach. They had an informal rota amongst themselves, so one or two would be there just to keep basic order, and the rest would go and do their thing. An image has stayed with me forever. And after that, John, I went looking for this phenomenon, right, everywhere.
Let's travel with you. You go to Nairobi, Kenya. You go to Accra, Ghana. You find Lagos, Nigeria, and eventually we wander the earth with you, James. You're in China. This is 20 years ago, Gansu, China. And what you discover is that everybody doesn't know about other countries doing this. The assumption is the one that I would have had. Private schools are for the elite. And in discovering these different places with these different schools, did you do it in the same fashion? Did you ask, let's go to the poorest part of the city? Or was there a guide to find these schools in Ghana or Kenya?
No, it was always, you know, I went to these places on my own, but typically I would have made a contact with some, you know, NGO, non-government organization, or a university or a think tank. I'd made some contact before I would get there. But typically in those days, you know, it does seem hard to believe now that I've been so involved in the sector, but in those days, 20, now 15 years ago, I would arrive in the country and I'd meet the person and they'd say, well, you may have found it in India, you may have found it in Kenya, but in our country, private schools are for the elite or the rich. And I would say, well, should we go to the slums together? Sometimes people wouldn't come to these slums because I remember in Lagos, for example, in Nigeria, when people arrive in Lagos, they travel across, you know, foreigners like us, they travel across to Victoria Island, VI, which is the posher part of town where the nicer hotels are. But if you travel across Third Mainland Bridge, you look down and there's this shanty town built on stilts into the black waters of the Lagos Lagoon. And I was there with my host taking me to the posh hotel. I said, that's where I want to go. That's where I think there'll be schools. And he said, no, you can't go there. It's too dangerous. And so the next day I had to go on my own. He wouldn't come. And there I found the low-cost schools, you know. And so it was all the time. You just went into these places. You would find the schools. And then I would then recruit a team using the local person to do the thorough research, to do the thorough tramping around, finding the schools, comparing achievement in the schools with the government schools. So it was an amazing journey. One of the reviewers of The Beautiful Tree said to me that I suffered from a overdose of wanderlust, and I guess that was true of those years.
A lot of flying hours. This is pre-pandemic world. The ability to travel to these different countries without the questions being asked. But you published Beautiful Tree in 2009, says my note, James. Correct me here. You were there. There is politics now because there's an election in 2010 in which the conservatives are successful, and you are introduced through a number of coincidences and because it is your mother country to Andrew Mitchell. Who is Andrew Mitchell in 2010, and how does that help the story move forward for England, for Great Britain, and then for the world?
Okay. So when I first met him, I guess he was Shadow Secretary of State for International Development. So that's the opposition person involved in development. And then he became, when the Conservatives they had to go in coalition with the Liberal Democrats in 2010, they then created the government. And he was then the Secretary of State for International Development. And he read my book. He got excited by this whole phenomenon. He went to see some of these schools in Lagos, Nigeria, and he recommended that this book should be read widely, and he recommended I should go and see the permanent secretary of DFID, the Department for International Development, who was very skeptical about this whole thing, very, very skeptical about this whole thing, and didn't really, you know, thought Andrew Mitchell was perhaps, you know, mistaken or exaggerating something. Anyway, he then was on a trip with the Prime Minister, David Cameron, to Lagos in Nigeria, and they went to see some of these schools that I've been talking about in that slum that I described, in the slum of, it's called Makoko, the one visible from Third Mainland Bridge as you go into town, go into the nice part of town. And he went to visit some of the schools, and in one of them that I'd actually put up a internet-connected computer, he emailed me and said, I haven't had many surprises in 27 years of development. This is one. I'm impressed by the quantity. You know, there were probably 30 low-cost private schools in that slum alone at the time, but also by the quality of what I've seen. And after that, the FID became convinced this was a sector worth looking at. And so many others followed suit as well. You know, other agencies all became interested in the sector. And why not become interested? Because that these schools are serving the majority of the urban.
But you have doubters, James. You have doubters. We'll turn to the BBC when we come back. Who doubt, James? The book is, the new book is Really Good Schools, Global Lessons for High-Caliber, Low-Cost Education. James Tooley is the author. The work is highly recommended by a distinguished panel of educators, including Chester Finn, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education, who reports, in the fascinating and provocative book, Really Good Schools, James Tooley applies his immense learning about low-cost, entirely private schools around the world to develop a daring and truly thought-provoking proposal along those lines for the United States. En route, he engages in a lively virtual argument with both Charles Murray and Milton Friedman. Check it out. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and James Tooley, the author of a new book, is with me, Really Good Schools, Global Lessons for High-Caliber, Low-Cost Education. James has discovered through his investigations throughout very poor parts of the former British Empire, but now Africa and Asia, that there are self-organized schools, independent of the government, independent of resources, doing very well, thank you very much. The BBC has questions, and there's an audit done by the government, I believe, of how many children, how many schools there are that qualify as low cost and private, and how many children are served. James, I have these notes. 12,098 schools serving 1.4 million children. Is that in India? Thank you.
No. So that figure is from Lagos, the state of Lagos in Nigeria. Nigeria is a federal state, a country, as you know, and Lagos is the commercial capital of Nigeria. And so I've been doing research suggesting that the majority of poor kids in the urban areas were in private schools. I've been making some estimate about how many this would be. But you know, I didn't have the resources to do this exactly. And then the Lagos state government, I think funded by DFID, the Department for International Development from the UK, they then insisted they do a proper census. My guess between you and me, hoping to prove Tooley wrong, you know, that actually there would be very few of these schools. And they found, as you say, over 12,000 schools serving 1.4 million children. And now we've been, we extrapolate from that evidence further. There's probably a 14,500 of those low-cost schools now serving probably two and a bit million kids. This is not a small-scale phenomenon. This is the key thing for your listeners to realize, that when I first talked about it, you know, people denied the existence or said, oh, you maybe found one or two business people ripping off the poor. Absolutely not. This is a mass phenomenon. That survey in Lagos showed 70% of school-aged children were in private schools. Other surveys across Africa now, Kampala in Uganda, 85% of poor kids are in private schools. Accra, Nairobi, similar figures. Delhi, Hyderabad, Bombay, Mumbai, similar figures. Huge majority of urban kids and substantial minorities of rural kids are in low-cost private schools, probably 30% in urban India, which means there are a substantial number of schools. Listen to this figure, 450,000 low-cost private schools in India. That's an estimate which I've made, but others concur with it. This is a mass movement across the developing world, and it's one that we need to take seriously. Absolutely.
Let's go to Liberia with you, Monrovia, the capital of Nigeria, of Liberia.
Liberia.
You arrive and you have a helpful driver, and you go to West Point and meet Mrs. Monroe. What is West Point, and what is Mrs. Monroe's occupation?
Okay. And so this is, let me put the context is, why Liberia, okay? So when I published The Beautiful Tree, remember I looked at Ghana, Kenya, Nigeria, India, China. A criticism I got was, okay, how can you say private schools are good for the poor? How can you say that and implying good for the poorest when you've gone to these countries which are now not the poorest countries, not the most difficult countries? You know, if you go elsewhere, you won't find this phenomenon. So I then took that criticism seriously and said, right, I'm going to go to war-torn, conflict-affected states in Africa. And I did the same study as I'd done before, but this time in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and South Sudan, where there'd been wars, or in the case of South Sudan, the civil war was still going on. And so, you know, as usual, I arrived in the country, in this case, I arrived at Monrovia Airport, took a taxi into town, found my hotel, then got a little local taxi, this wonderful guy called Edward, he sort of understood what I was after, and I said, I want to go to the slums, and nearest slums, he said, West Point's a place, which is this, just you know, these slums are the same across West Africa, you know, just very poor shanty towns, you know, mud buildings, simple brick buildings, no latrines, open drains, open sewers into the, and it's a peninsula going into the sea there. And I arrived, and Edward very kindly accompanied me. I said, let's go down this alley. We asked someone, I'm looking for low-cost private schools. Do you know any? And this woman said, yeah, just go down there. Turn left, turn right, past the women braiding each other's hair, and you'll find. And there, sure enough, was Mrs. Monroe and Crewe Beach Elementary and Junior School. She was the first low-cost private school proprietor I found there in Liberia. And, yeah, again, one of very many in these places. And, you know, she said, I asked her the usual question. I sat down with her, so excited. I get so excited when I go to these new countries and find the same phenomenon. Because remember, I told people I was going to Liberia, and they said, you won't find low-cost private schools there. And then the first day there, finding the schools. Why do children come to your school? I asked her. She says, oh, sometimes the government school is full. But the woman who had accompanied me there said, no, teachers in public schools don't pay full-time attention with the children. I wrote it down verbatim. She knew why. That was why. And these schools are thriving there. In the slums, we looked at 7 slums, I think, in Monrovia, including West Point. One was called Chicken Soup Factory. You can probably guess why that was called so called. It was the slum around the Chicken Soup Factory. There's one called Red Light, the slum there. You'd be wrong if you guessed why that was called. It was named after the functioning traffic light in Monrovia. But these slums, 71% of the kids in these slums were in low-cost private schools. An extraordinary.
James, we just have less than a minute here before we turn to the thinking about these schools. But did they know about each other? Were they organized, James, in Monrovia?
No. So I helped them create a Liberian Independent Schools Association, LISA, where that we would have some form of associations. I've done that in a few countries. In Nigeria, there's wonderful AFED, the Association of Formidable Education Development. In India, NISA, the National Independent Schools Association. So there are now associations. I would love to create a global federation of these schools where people could learn from each other's experience. That's perhaps for the future. But there are associations, and they do learn about each other.
Let's turn to the thinking behind all of these schools, independently or together. Really Good Schools is the book, Global Lessons for High-Caliber, Low-Cost Education. James Tooley is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and James Tooley, the author of the new book, Really Good Schools, Global Lessons for High-Caliber, Low-Cost Education. The earlier book is Beautiful Tree. James published more than a decade ago now. The Beautiful Tree, a personal journey into the how the world's poorest people are educating themselves. But James, as he's explaining to us, is still discovering these schools in faraway places. But coming to America, coming to Britain, is that possible as well? Is it necessary to be extremely poor and isolated in order to form a school of your own? And James, you ask questions about there are reasons for people being alienated from public school systems paid for by the state. And you ask questions of people who are about to form a public school if on their own, a private school on their own. And I want to go through the list of seven for you to explain to people listening right now how they might think about this. First, scalability. What does that mean, James?
We can think of this in terms of development often. This is scalability and sustainability. These are often the sort of the holy grails of development. If something isn't scalable, then how can it reach many? You can reach one or two, you know, small number of poor people, but you can't reach many. In the context of coming to America or coming to England, here you've got the same issue. If we really want to make a difference and we believe that something we're working with can really make a difference, then we want it to be scalable. We don't just want one, you know, I've created a low-cost school in the northeast of England, one of the poorer parts of England. I've created one there, but no one's going to be impressed by just one little school on its own. We've got to create more schools. I want more people to come in and, you know, do the same thing that I've been doing. We can create smaller chains of these schools, networks of these schools. Once we've got scalability, then we know this is a solution that can work not just for a couple of kids, but for the many, possibly for all.
Afford, that's obvious. The affordability and the quality. Those things come together, of course, because people are thinking about the value for their money. How do they work for people coming to low-cost, thinking about low-cost schooling?
So the affordability, again, this, if we think about that in developing countries, I've done a lot of research showing that the low-cost private schools, not surprisingly, these schools that we find in the slums of, as you said, Monrovia and other parts of the world, these schools are affordable to parents on the poverty line. So this is really important. The parents on the poverty line, they don't have to spend more than 10% of their income on school fees for all of their children. And there is a school for them at the price they can afford. Now, coming to England and America, what are the figures we can use? Well, in England, and I think you have the same there in America, you have something called disposable income, but also discretionary income. So disposable income is the income that anyone can spend on a wide variety of things, food and clothing. So, and discretionary is that bit that's left over for treats, for holidays, for, you know, exceptional items. And what I've shown is that the school fees we charged up north in this little school I just mentioned in passing would be affordable by the second lowest quintile in terms of discretionary income. So not the poorest, but the second lowest. That's an achievement. That's an advance, because private schools at the moment are only affordable by the top quintile and probably the top decile within that. So that's very important. So when we're trying to think about this as an alternative movement, this is what perhaps we're getting at. Affordability is so important, and ideally we want to see prices go down so that the lowest quintile can afford them.
Yes, the number I've written down here is you asked the parents who are interested in this, and they said £50 a week. Is that out of date now? I mean, inflation and the pandemic and all, or is that the number that you still can use, James?
Yeah, so it was actually, was it 50 or 52 pounds? Anyway, we went in at £52 a week, and we're up to about £60 a week.
Okay.
So, you know, it's not a million miles away. And that's important what you said about there about per week, because, you know, too often people think about school fees as being, okay, this is what we spend per year or per term, don't they, or per semester. And yet my experience in developing countries was often schools had daily fees. Those cash flow of the poor is daily or weekly fees and so on. And I just prefer, I thought it's probably easier for people to think about the cost of schools if they were thinking about them in terms of, you know, what you can afford weekly rather than this bigger figure that would come out semester or term wise.
All right. Concerns. Value and equity. How do you describe those, James?
So value for money. Now, this again, in the developing country research where we look at there, we compare government schools, what do you, American school, public schools, with the private schools. And there, I was just very, you can do calculations where, okay, this is the achievement on standardized tests or special tests that we've put, given the children in both public and private. This is the achievement, and this is the cost of the schooling. Now, in the private schools, that cost is borne by parents. In the government schools, it's borne by the state, or, you know, maybe some combination of state and parents. But nonetheless, typically we see that per achievement point, per achievement in mathematics and English, the private schools are much more, much better value for money than the government schools. So that's there. And equity, obviously private schools have got to be fair. If they're going to be part of any development solution or any solution to education in America or England, then they've got to be fair. They've got to be fair to girls. You know, people, there's this myth about private schools in places like we've been talking about, Liberia, Sierra Leone, that they're unfair to girls. It's not true. But of course, we have to make sure that's not true in order to justify promoting these schools.
And choice. What is the choice offered to parents, because they're making the decision about committing their resources? What is attractive to them? I'm guessing that matters continent to continent. But you have some fundamentals that you convey, and I wrote them down quickly. Knowledge, skills, disposition, and values. All things that come from the family, but do they also come from these schools? Are those questions asked, James?
They are asked, and I think the important thing to recall about choice is that these private schools, parents are going into them with their eyes open. So a lot of our critics, a lot of my critics, you know, once I started publicizing this work, talking about it to great people like yourself, people would say, no, parents are being forced into these schools, or they're being hoodwinked. You know, they want to go to private school, they're poor. Who wouldn't want to go to private school? So they just go along to something that's totally inadequate. They like the uniforms or whatever. And my work has shown, no, they go into these schools with their eyes open. They see the knowledge that's being brought into these schools is better, and we've proven that the dispositions, the character, all these things are improved within these schools, and they are, so they go into their eyes open, and they're able to list the things that are better in the government schools and better in the private schools, which occur more frequently in the government schools and occur more frequently in the private schools. In the private schools, it's things like closer attention to the children, safe place for girls, aspirational. What's more frequent in the government schools? Teachers are on strike. Teachers don't turn up. Classes are crowded. So parents understand what they're talking about, what their choices they're making. They're not blind.
And finally, sustainability. You mentioned that already. Does that mean you have a pool of children and there are children that are going to come for years? Do you think about the teachers? Do you think about the administrators, the resources? How to imagine this for somebody thinking about it now, James?
Well, so thinking about starting a school here, you know, if that's what we're trying, if that's where we're going now. So if someone wanted to start a low-cost school in America, you've got to make sure it's sustainable. You might be able to get, you know, maybe someone will give you a grant or a donation, or family members will help you out in order to set up the school. But this has got to be able to last. It's got to be able to stand on its own 2 feet. It can't be forever subsidized from outside. So the sustainability is important. The costs of the schools must match or be less than the fee income you can get from parents. That's what I mean by sustainability. We're not talking about charity here, incidentally. We're talking about small businesses that are better serving low-income families in the developing world than the public alternative, and I reckon you can do similar things here.
I recall an anecdote as you used the word charity. Weren't you chastised by someone once? And he said, "We don't want your charity." Didn't you hear that, James?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of my first days when I went into these low-cost private schools in Hyderabad in India, and, you know, sitting there just totally in awe at what I was seeing. You know, it's probably the fifth private school I'd visited. I was so impressed, and this poor Muslim mother came in, you know, in her hijab, and she owed money for for the her school fees for her child. And of course, there's a foreigner there, and the school fees are so low. You get out a wadge of rupees from your pocket and say, "Oh, you take it and fund your child." And absolutely, no, I don't want your charity. What I value in this school is the school is accountable to me. I'm sort of paraphrasing now, of course, but the school is accountable to me, and therefore I'm going to be spending my money. I don't want foreigners coming in and helping. Very profound lesson, really.
The book is Really Good Schools, Global Lessons for High-Caliber, Low-Cost Education. James Tooley is the author. We're going to America with James. The recommendations for Really Good Schools continue from John Summer, Knight Distinguished Professor Emeritus, University of North Carolina at Charlotte. In Really Good Schools, James Tooley presents a compelling argument for education in contradistinction to schooling, a difference seemingly lost in the bureaucracies of public education. He identifies the possibilities and promise of private education as a ground-up, spontaneously ordered enterprise that can serve even the lowest-income individuals more effectively than can the administrative state. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and James Tooley, educator, philosopher of education and educator, coming to America. His book is Really Good Schools, Global Lessons for High-Caliber, Low-Cost Education. He has created a low-cost private school in the North, as he says, in Buckinghamshire, in the Great Britain. But coming to America, James has very careful language here because there are what appear to be self-organized learning environments, that's a concept that I'll ask immediately about, in America called charter schools and also schools that are the products of vouchers. Both of those ideas have been advanced by philosophers of education for some decades, most notably Milton Friedman of the Hoover Institution, whom I had an occasion to chat with before he left us, James, and it was a pleasure how passionate he is about charter schools and their success in America. But you make the very careful point that after all these years of attention and publicity and success, it's still a very small percentage of American children, very small, and is always under pressure to prove itself to the school system that is part of the arrangement. They use the charter schools, for example, use school buildings for their success, and that's not entirely what you would have to say is independent. So coming to America, the question first is, do I describe what you're recommending as a self-organized learning environment? What does that mean, James? Because you use it several times throughout the book.
Yes, and you used it in terms of charter schools and vouchers and that's I wouldn't include those. So what I'm talking about in terms of spontaneous order or self-organized learning environment is a situation where learning takes place, where education takes place, which is organized or which emerges outside of any centralized state, centralized public control or direction. So what I've been describing the program so far, remember, we recall back in Monrovia, in Lagos, in Delhi, the majority of school children and the majority of poor school children are in private schools. No government has decided that. In fact, it goes against what governments want. No government decided that, but the people themselves, this grassroots movement, you know, one parent starts a school, one entrepreneur starts a school, many start being formed. Children go to these schools in preference. It's a spontaneous order that emerges, and that is a really exciting phenomenon. But in America, now you've mentioned Milton Friedman, the late great Milton Friedman. He was in favor of vouchers, and it was for a very particular reason that if you're in a democracy, you need universal vouchers so that everyone can have schooling. And what I say in that sort of third part of my book, Really Good Schools, I say, well, this sounds great. And, you know, when I first started hearing about school choice in America, I thought, wow, vouchers, they sound wonderful. This is where the money for education gets given to the parent and they take it along to the school of their choice. And so schools thrive or or don't, depending on how many children go there. But I looked at the data, and I saw that the percentage of children enrolled on voucher programs in the US is less than half of 1%. And even when you throw in charter schools, it's still only about, you know, 5 or 6% of all children, school children in America, are enrolled in these school choice programs. And then I look back at what the work I've been doing around the world and say, well, that's 70-80% of urban children, or, you know, 30+% of rural children. Overall, 50-60% of children are in these schools. Isn't there something that's much more exciting than vouchers and charter schools that can actually transform education? Isn't this movement that I've seen of low-cost schools elsewhere even more exciting? And the funny thing is, Milton Friedman changed his mind about vouchers, and he didn't see the evidence that I've been accumulating over the world. He would have loved it, I'm sure, by the way. He would have loved seeing these low-cost private schools in the slums of Monrovia or Juba in South Sudan. He would have loved it. But he looked at the historical evidence, or he looked at the historical evidence of Professor E.G. West, who'd written about the situation in England and Wales, and also the situation in New York and Massachusetts, I think. And the evidence is quite extraordinary. From England and Wales, the Newcastle Commission data from 1858, this is before the state got involved in education, showed that 95% of children were in school for 6 years. In America, there was evidence from 1821, I believe, well before compulsory schooling, with only small state subsidies. The vast majority of children in New York State were in school well before compulsion and before free schooling. So Milton Friedman saw that evidence and realized that his argument for vouchers no longer stood, and that therefore he would see vouchers as a stepping stone towards this sort of spontaneous order, the self-organizing learning system of low-cost or private schools for all, including low-cost private schools. And, you know, I mentioned at the beginning of this program, I had a hunch about what I might find in the slums of India when I first went in there. It was because of this finding of Milton Friedman using the work of Professor E.G. West. I wondered if what was true in the slums of Victorian England might also be true of the slums of India and Africa now. And it was a hunch that proved right.
You have advanced in your book the cities you find most likely to be attractive to low-cost private schools. I'll read them through quickly, and you can comment about why you chose these cities and what to look for in other cities in America. Milwaukee, St. Louis, Charlotte, North Carolina, Atlanta, Georgia, Jacksonville, Florida, and Louisville, Kentucky. What links those in your mind, James, as to why low cost would work there?
Yeah, and look, I don't want to overdo this table here. What I was looking at here was on the major. I had a few criteria. One was on the regulatory environment. You know, would the regulatory environment be conducive to low cost private schools, or would it be would it put a strain on them, particularly in terms of teacher certification, teacher pay, curriculum flexibility?
We've got about one minute, James. Go ahead, please.
Okay, so those cities scored highly on that. Also, I looked at population. Also, I looked at the waiting lists for charter schools, because that suggested to me if there was a long waiting list for charter schools, there were parents hungry for an alternative, and they might not be able to get the charter schools, they might be able to get this alternative of low-cost private education.
And these all met that criteria. There'll be many more states like this. Final thought, James, back to your first visit in India, the revelation that you've had. Have you heard from other people who have this similar revelation when they visit schools? Do people write you all the time? We've got 30 seconds, James.
Yeah, this movement that I discovered, not obviously for the people in India or Africa, no, but for people back here, I discovered that movement. And many people now are writing to me and saying, yes, we've seen this ourselves. Do you know, I've been having some wonderful correspondence with people in Caracas, Venezuela, over the last few weeks. And they were interested in my book, translated into Spanish, and they've been looking, and they found the same thing in Caracas. It's wonderful to find this phenomenon from across the world, low-cost private schools, the poor finding, not acquiescing in the mediocrity of public education, finding better things for themselves. It's so exciting.
James Tooley is the author. Really Good Schools, Global Lessons for High-Caliber, Low-Cost Education. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.